Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What kind of mythical powers does a Sun Devil have? We got to consider that.
It's embarrassing, but we are who we are. We're not a very good team, but we're 3-1 somehow, and we got all the voters fooled, thinking we're pretty good.
Jaworski Lane at 275 pounds showed a heck of a lot of athletic ability.
Welcome to the RotoWire College Football Podcast. It is Tuesday, December 7th. We are recapping Conference Championship Weekend. This is the Matthias Kiwanuka of College Football Podcast. John McKechnie, who always joins me on Tuesdays and for our preview shows later in the week, which we'll probably have to wait until we get some more meaningful bowl games to get back to those. But a ton to recap on this Tuesday from Conference Championship Weekend. And Jonathan, reluctantly, I think we need to start in the SEC. We're not going to go in order of how these games transpired. This was the biggest game of the weekend. Had huge implications for ultimately what transpired with the college football playoff. And not to give anything away, but based on what happened, both Alabama and Georgia are now in the college football playoff. And Alabama, not Georgia, is the number one team in the country. So you can connect the dots. And you were in attendance at this game in Atlanta. You were on the scene. It looked like a full day, full night, full weekend, really, for you. Walk us through, what your mindset was heading into the game, what your mindset was once the game started, and then where you were at mentally, in the closing moments of this one.
Yeah, man, it's a lot to unpack here. It was, something that obviously you've been looking forward to for a long time. I'm getting all excited. The group kind of has an idea of what we're going to do to watch the game. I have basically no designs of going to the game. Get a call from a buddy on Friday asking if I wanted to go. And I'm like, well, sure. But like, what's it looking like? He's like, well, is free too much? And I'm like, well, okay. Twist my arm. So ended up, kind of falling into a ticket just kind of out of nowhere on Friday afternoon. So focus was difficult for the rest of the day on Friday. Saturday rolls around, people descend upon my apartment, and we head on over to the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, do a little tailgating. I'd never been to the Benz before. That was a really cool stadium. It's massive and obviously brand new and very nice, everything like that. Good sight lines, get to the seats. Georgia just goes ahead. I'll get into the game, of course. That's the most important part. So Georgia goes up 10-0 first quarter. Look like they're starting to kind of impose their will a little bit. They get the 98-yard touchdown drive culminating in that touchdown to Darnell Washington. You're like, okay, like we might be on here. Like this is good. This is kind of what I was expecting us to be able to do, where the defense is showing up and the offense is playing a good kind of possession style, trying to keep Alabama on the sidelines as much as they can and just going from there. But second quarter is obviously where everything fell apart. What I talked about on Thursday was my concern, saying that basically the way that Alabama can beat Georgia is the same way that great offenses have just beaten great defenses over the course of the last few years. And that's kind of the new trend in modern college football. So no matter how good your defense is, it almost doesn't matter. And we started to see it with these explosive plays. Georgia hadn't really faced a team that could pull those off against them all year that they went away from the game plan that they stuck with their own game plan. They didn't really go with the things that made teams like Auburn or Texas A&M successful, where they brought added pressure. Georgia mostly was bringing four guys on any given down. It was what they call is like a simulated pressure, so that it's four guys. You just don't know where it's coming from. And they stuck to that because they were worried about their corners, understandably so. But at a certain point, you need to find a way to get to Bryce Young. They weren't able to do that. I think a lot of the game kind of swung on that Bryce Young fumble that he was able to miraculously recover despite a bunch of Bulldogs being around him. Alabama goes ahead, scores there, and then the classic Dabo Swinney middle eight. Alabama dominated that, and it changed everything. It went from being a close game to all of a sudden Georgia's down 31-17 early in the third quarter, and they never really recovered from that. The defense played a little bit better in the second half. Offense stopped playing well in the second half, I thought, for the most part. And, Bama just proved to be the better team that day. They played what I thought to be easily their best game of the season, and they played it at the exact right time, and they're the deserving number one team in the country now going into the playoff. And I think that they – have to be kind of like the odds-on favorite now that they get to go up against Cincinnati in the first round. And obviously they have this undeniable mental edge over Georgia. And you'd expect if Michigan beats Georgia, then you would think that they're pretty healthy favorites against Michigan as well. So Bama has kind of gone through this uneven season, but now they sit there in position to win yet another national title.
I think that was a great summation. You hit on pretty much everything that I have in my notes here. I mean, it was a game that Georgia controlled early on, but even when they were up 10-0, for some reason to me, they had forced two quick punts by Alabama on its first two possessions. You never quite felt like Georgia was dominating this game early on, even though the score at 10-0 indicated that. But they go on that that eight play 97-yard drive, top it off with the touchdown, and three plays later, Jameson Williams is running by the entire Georgia defense for a 67-yard touchdown. And it's like, okay, here we go. Georgia needs to respond. And they come out with a immediate three and out. They burn just over a minute off the clock, three and out. Alabama comes down, long drive, get a big stop if you're Georgia to force the field goal. But at that time, I mean, the Jameson Williams touchdown to me, I guess, signaled like, okay, this is not going to be one of those games where Alabama is going to have to scratch and claw for every single thing they get. And it was just shocking to see Georgia give up those kind of plays. I mean, it's one thing for Jameson Williams, who's just one of the fastest guys in the country, but time after time, they were able to hit those gash plays through the air. And honestly, on the other side, I didn't really think Stetson Bennett played all that badly. I mean, he had two picks. The second one, a pick six, essentially sealed the game. They were already down two touchdowns at that point. But it just felt like Alabama came in and was able to do exactly what they wanted to do. And I don't know if Georgia played too conservatively or kind of played not to lose, but if you went in and like removed the logos from all the uniforms and the helmets and said like which team is the one that's ran through everybody all year, you would think it was Alabama. And it just felt like Georgia, you kept hearing the narrative of like, oh well, actually when you look at their schedule, they weren't really tested by a team like this all year. I also didn't really feel like that was the result. It was just a strange game by Georgia. And again, getting up 10-0, feeling like they're in control, not being able to put the pedal to the metal there, I think is a little bit concerning when you start to project out, what to expect against Michigan and potentially in a rematch against Alabama in the national title game.
Yeah, absolutely. So it really did feel kind of myself and my friends obviously dissected this game for like the following 24 hours afterward, just constant lamentations about it from Saturday night and into Sunday and everything. But it really did feel like when Jameson Williams scored that first touchdown to make it 10-7, it felt like at that point Georgia was losing. It was that significant of a play. Now we're in a situation where Alabama unfortunately loses John Metchie for the rest of the season, but they are so loaded at receiver. So I don't know how much it's really going to matter. It's just going to be a new face in there, basically being able to do almost what John Metchie was able to do. But as long as they have Jameson Williams out there, it's and Bryce Young's not getting hit, then it's going to be really hard to stop Alabama. And I think part of the reason why Bryce Young was able to pick apart Georgia so well, in addition to the coverage, was just Alabama's offensive line that had been famously maligned throughout the course of the season played its best game. I mean, they really didn't let Georgia, Jordan Davis, Jermaine Carter, everybody else, the edge rushers, get through whatsoever. I mean, if you allow Bryce Young to operate with a clean pocket and, you know, you're having him drop back that many times, he is going to eat you alive. That much became very, very clear. And obviously he, you know, was able to put himself, it basically sealed himself the Heisman with that one.
Yeah, I thought this was a masterful game for Bryce Young. And he had a couple throws that I think I texted you of, like, he has two throws in this half that would be the greatest throws in Wisconsin football history by a mile. I mean, one of those just running under it was Jameson Williams. And I mean, the accurate, like, just not having to break stride whatsoever. And Young has had a couple of those throws this year. But man, it's really, really impressive what he was able to do against this defense. But like you said, the Alabama offensive line held up. I don't know if it was a case of, you know, Georgia dialing up the wrong pressures, or all of a sudden Alabama's, you know, offensive line, which had just been probably average to slightly above average at best all season, just decided to all of a sudden look like the best line in the country. But it's funny, like Bryce Young, even when he is under pressure, he has a way of just looking more poised than other quarterbacks. Like, he stands so still. Like, his shoulders are always down, like hands are down almost at his, like, towards his knees. Like, you know, a lot of quarterbacks are standing there looking around, patting the ball. Like, he's so chill in the pocket. And then all of a sudden he'll just, you know, quickly whip out a 60-yard throw for a touchdown. I mean, he was amazing. He's going to win the Heisman. To me, it still doesn't quite feel like a classic, like, dominant Heisman season that we've seen from a lot of quarterbacks, especially over the last decade or so. But, you know, the other finalists are Aiden Hutchinson, Kenny Pickett, and C.J. Stroud. I think he's going to win it pretty easily. I would say he's probably going to get, what, 70%+ of the first place votes?
I would guess so. I don't think that you can really make a case, a strong one, that anyone deserves it more than him. I mean, just based on kind of what wins you the Heisman, basically for over the last 20, 30 years, essentially, being the best quarterback for the best team usually does it. And he obviously, you know, left it about as strong of a final impression as you could possibly make it with that SEC championship performance, just absolutely ripping Georgia apart.
So neither of these teams were really able to run the ball all that well. I think we expected that from Alabama. They end up outrushing Georgia 115 yards on 26 carries, one rushing touchdown. That was by Bryce Young. But Georgia only 109 yards on 30 carries, did not get into the end zone on the ground. How much of a concern is that for you, I guess, going into a game against a Michigan team that has, you know, arguably two of the four or five best defensive ends in the entire country? You're going up against I think on defense, at least somewhat of a similar opponent to what you just faced in Alabama.
Yeah, I think you could probably argue that Michigan's defense is scarier overall, especially when you have Hutchinson and Ojabo. I did think that Georgia did a good job of not letting Will Anderson completely wreck that game. I don't think that he made any plays that really completely changed it one way or the other. But I think Georgia could have similarly difficult situations trying to get the run game going in that Orange Bowl. And then if you expose Stetson Bennett to that pass rush because the run game's not working, then, you know, you start to get into trouble. You expose him to getting hit by guys like Hutchinson and Ojabo. You don't like his chances of being able to survive that particularly well, or not turning the ball over if he's getting constantly pressured by those guys. So that is going to be a huge, huge storyline for the Orange Bowl, how Georgia is able to do against this Michigan offense. I don't think that Michigan has the type of guys that can do the things that made Alabama so successful at it. They're just not really a explosive team on offense when it comes to going to the air. We haven't really seen that out of Cade McNamara. They did hit some big plays, of course, against Iowa. We can get to that game here in a second. But if Michigan continues its script, you know, where they're running the ball 60% of the time, I don't think that's going particularly well for them either. So there's a lot more to get to when it comes to how that matchup sets up. And I've got a lot more homework to do on it. But at least as far as how Georgia's offense looks right now, you got to be concerned going into a game against a Michigan defense that's as fierce as it is, because I still think you could argue it's better than Alabama's, and Alabama's did a very good job against Georgia's offense this past weekend.
Dogs open up as 7.5-point favorites in that Orange Bowl game against the University of Michigan. We could talk about the Big Ten title game. This was the nightcap. It was pretty much over, you know, by halftime, even though it was only 14-3 at that point. A lot of Michigan scoring in a game that they scored 42 points on, 21 of those came in the final 11 minutes of the game. So they did tack on some points that were ultimately relatively meaningless. But this game was just controlled completely by Michigan's defense. Iowa was stopped on 10 straight drives to end this game. They were 5 of 19 on third down. Spencer Petras ends up being benched in this one. You know, like you said, Michigan did hit a few big plays. They had touchdown drives of one play, four plays, six plays, eight plays, and 10 plays. So kind of the opposite of what we saw against Ohio State when they were really able to control the ball in that game. Iowa actually won the time of possession battle in this game. But I mean, it felt like the Hawkeyes were overmatched from the jump.
Yeah, that's the sense that I got. I was, you know, kind of in transit back into town during the early part of that game, but still had eyes on, still following along. And yeah, I mean, we thought that Michigan was the better team by a decent margin going into that one. You know, obviously they're 10.5 point favorites going into that one. And they proved it. I mean, the defense was absolutely stifling against an Iowa offense that just was going to kind of need to use smoke and mirrors to be able to generate anything. And they probably needed a defensive touchdown, kind of like they have all year, in order to really keep this thing competitive. But Michigan was smart with the ball. You know, Blake Corum was explosive on the carries that he got. Haskins punched in a couple of touchdowns in his own right. So they got it done that way and then hit some other explosive ones along the way there. So just, you know, kind of a good culmination from Michigan. I think that you wondered if there was one other way that Iowa gets in, or, you know, makes this one a little bit more competitive, is how gassed is Michigan after like the most emotional win that program has had in quite some time. But no, they remained laser focused. That they went in there and just kind of finished the drill, did what they had to do to secure their spot in the playoff and to win their first Big Ten title in quite some time as well. So just kudos to Michigan. That was impressive. They've been an excellent team all year, really strong. And for them to do that, losing their best receiver in the opening game of the season, just very impressive. And the way that Hutchinson and Ojabo have come along this year, and then Dax Hill in the back end. Yeah, they are no joke. Like, I don't think that Georgia can take that game lightly whatsoever. Not that any team in the playoff takes any of those games lightly, but I think Michigan has a very legitimate shot of playing on January 10th as well.
Iowa, meanwhile, heading to the Citrus Bowl against the University of Kentucky. Let's rewind to the early window. This was an 11 a.m. kickoff for me in the Central Time Zone. Baylor 21, Oklahoma State 16. A bizarre, at times poorly played game. That terrible first half for Spencer Sanders and that Oklahoma State offense, but they rallied back and put together a 17-play drive to end this game that ultimately falls 1 yard short, shades of Kevin Dyson. Oklahoma State stopped 6 times in a row from the 10-yard line or closer. They got a pass interference on there that moved the ball to the 2. And then Desmond Jackson stopped on 3 of those 4 plays. There was an incomplete pass in there as well. It was one of those where, like, immediately in retrospect, you're like, oh, I could have called plays. I would have got them into the end zone. but more than anything, I mean, props to the Baylor defense. Even on that last play on 4th and goal from the 1, it certainly looked to me like Desmond Jackson had the angle to get in. And you could kind of see on the replay where, like, plant foot that he was planning to kind of make that final dive into the end zone kind of slipped, and he just couldn't quite get enough momentum.
Yeah, I mean, like, you should, like, overlay the music from, like, late in the Friday Night Lights movie over that. I mean, that was just, it was just, like, so, oh my gosh, what an insane ending sequence for you know, in such a huge spot there in Jerry World for the Big 12 championship. And you know, gosh, if Oklahoma State punches it in there, I don't know that Georgia's in the playoff.
Oh, come on. Well, I think at that point, I think that was probably the more likely option, right? I mean, the fact that Georgia is still above Cincinnati, to me, is an indication of how that would have gone. But at that time, Cincinnati had not played. So if you're Oklahoma State, you're thinking, we win this and we're rooting hard for Houston to beat Cincinnati, which was a possibility, ultimately did not happen. So maybe if there is one positive you can take away from this, if you're Oklahoma State, it's that, you know, chances are you probably still weren't getting into the playoff. But yeah, I mean, who knows how it plays out.
Yeah, it was crazy. I can't believe how badly Oklahoma State played, especially in that first half, like you mentioned. I watched a good bit of that game before heading over to the stadium, and they just kept making these colossal errors, and it was so unlike what they had been pretty much the entire season. So unfortunate end to what was an awesome season for Oklahoma State. They get, you know, a pretty fun bowl game, I believe, against Notre Dame. So that'll be cool. But, you know, if you're okay, State, you hate to see it end like that and mm-hmm. on something that another program is going to be talking about for the rest of time. Like, it was, what an unbelievable goal line stand from Baylor.
Yeah, unbelievable finish to this game. Unbelievable reaction from Dave Aranda, who just looked like he had finished up watching like the most boring movie of all time. No reaction whatsoever on the stop. I don't know if he was just waiting for like a flag to come out or making sure that they didn't get across the goal line from his angle, but the most muted reaction you're ever going to see in that situation. Oklahoma State still ends up, you know, in a New Year's Six. They play Notre Dame in what should be actually a pretty fun Fiesta Bowl matchup. And Baylor ends up in the Sugar Bowl against Ole Miss. I actually like a lot of these secondary bowl games that we ended up with.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot of good stuff to enjoy here this bowl season. I like a lot of these matchups, and yeah, like that, it feels like the New Year's Six actually really does have some punch to it. And I think sometimes you run into a slate of New Year's Six games where it's very clear that one of these teams is so disappointed that they might mail it in. We've seen that time and time again, but I'm not getting that vibe at all from this year. I think OK State, Notre Dame is going to be sweet. Baylor Ole Miss is going to be a lot of fun as well. Game that's not in the New Year's Six, and it's the most random kind of just sad bowl. It kicks off at 9 Eastern on Tuesday, January 4th. Why do they do this? LSU, Kansas State. Why do they do this at
why on that Tuesday? Why is it that day?
Yeah, squeeze it in and somewhere else.
Yeah,
I'd be so mad if I was one of the players in that one. Like, it just like let it end.
I mean, this is 3 days after. Like, you know, the traditional New Year's Day bowl games. This is well after the first round of the playoff games. Like, I could see playing this one on, like, you know, push it back and play it that Friday or something before the national title game or that Saturday. I mean, maybe there's NFL games at that point. This just seems like maybe there was some sort of scheduling conflict at wherever the Tax Act Texas Bowl is being played.
Yep. Either way, tough scene. And that's going to be – there's, I guess in recent years there always has been, like, that funky – hanger-on bowl game the week after the playoff and everything is decided. But that one is particularly funny just because of those two teams, the way that they've played this season, is just it's gonna be, that's a gross way to end,
right?
Like, or have like the penultimate college football game of the season.
I mean, if you're LSU, like, how many fans are making the trip to Houston for that one? This is being played at NRG Stadium, the Texan Stadium, which is fairly close by, but you're 2 years removed from winning the national title. You know, a lot of people went to that game. A lot of people traveled to other LSU road games or neutral games. Like, what percentage of the fan base is like, all right, pack it up, we're heading out, we got to go beat Kansas State?
Yeah, my only guess is the LSU students who are still on Christmas break.
Yeah,
that are Houston natives, because there are, of which there are plenty. But even then, like, those kids will probably be like in Breckenridge or something. Like, they're just not gonna want to spend any money to go see that a Tuesday night bowl game against K-State, completely meaningless. I can't imagine I could see a lot of LSU players opting out of that game as well.
Yeah, I could see LSU as a team just opting out.
Yeah, they might just want
to take the forfeit. I don't know if that's even allowed. I will say I'm glad Wisconsin also has a late night bowl on Thursday, December 30th, the SRS Distribution Las Vegas Bowl, or the SDLVB, kicks off at 10:30 Eastern time on Thursday, December 30th.
Yeah, we'll see if I believe I'll be driving back to Georgia that day. We'll see how much I catch of that one. But I don't know.
Have you locked in plans to watch football. The first round?
We're still figuring out. We're all so rattled from Saturday that I think that, like, we can't even really think about New Year's yet, even though there's an obvious need to do that because it's just 3 weeks from this Friday. But yeah, at this stage, no one's really come up with a great idea for what they're going to do for the playoff. I don't think anyone that I know is going to go down to Miami. So they're actually, you know, that my friend group does not represent the entirety of the University of Georgia's fan base, but I could definitely see Michigan having that stadium over a little bit.
Absolutely. I think especially, you know, a team that hasn't had this kind of success in a while, I think you're itching for the opportunity to go on a trip like that. Let's go back to Cincinnati, Houston. Again, a game that had pretty major implications coming into the day. And as soon as Oklahoma State goes down, if you're Cincinnati, you pretty much know at that point, if we win this game, we are going to go to the college football playoff, which in some ways almost makes it, you know, more pressure packed. You know, I think knowing that you know, everything is in front of you, you control your own destiny. And this game was close for a little bit early on. It was 14-13 at the half. Cincinnati comes out, scores a touchdown on its first drive of the third quarter, gets a pick immediately on the next Houston drive, and then a quick score for Cincinnati. And at that point, we're pretty much off and running. And Cincinnati went from being up 1 point to, like, you know, 20 minutes of real time later, all of a sudden this game is 35-13.
Right, exactly. So that was just such a huge sequence. I remember checking my phone and seeing that you know, Houston was putting up a very, very legit fight. And we talked about that a little bit on the Thursday show, you know, giving respect to a Houston team that had won 11 games in a row and hadn't lost since the season opener. But yeah, Cincinnati really did what it had to coming out of half there and really kind of started to put that game away, scoring those 21 points in the third quarter to just kind of to cinch it. Houston, you know, scores a late touchdown in the fourth to make it a little bit closer. But yeah, since he won and they covered. And when you covered, that makes you a great team. And that obviously helped but it did cinch everything, and it put them into the playoff, and kudos to them. They've had an unbelievable couple seasons run under Luke Fickell and Desmond Ridder and you know, Sauce Gardner, of course, and Kobe Bryant with a C, Kobe Bryant, all these dudes on Cincinnati, a lot of fun to watch. And, you know, I'm excited to see what they can do against Alabama. I know the spread kind of goes to show you what the difference might really look like, you know, about two touchdowns, but mm-hmm. Cincinnati's going to give them everything they got. I know that for a fact.
Well, I compared this, I think, last week to, you know, when Hawaii went and played Georgia and got smacked around by Matthew Stafford. Do you think it's more likely that we see a game like that, or we see a game that, you know, midway through the third quarter, Cincinnati's hanging around?
I still haven't completely sanded down my take just yet. I don't think shot. Right. Yep. Still there. You know, waiting for my belt sanders and so on to get there. Just completely telling myself that I don't know anything about woodworking.
Sounds like you do.
Right. I gave it a run. That game against Georgia with Hawaii just had zero things going on for them in the trenches. Like they just got Colt Brennan smashed for that entire game. I don't know if Bama's defensive line matches up quite, like, it's quite big of a mismatch against Cincy's O-line. We'll see. I'd probably be guessing that it is, though, at least to some extent. I don't really see the miracle Boise State versus Oklahoma type of setup here. I think Alabama just simply, they don't lose those type of games. And so maybe Cincy keeps it interesting, but there will be a moment where Alabama just breaks their spirit and just kind of pulls away is my guess.
Yeah. And like you said, you know, the 13.5 point spread, which I would not be surprised, you know, swells up a little bit over these next few weeks. That would kind of indicate where the public is on this game. Let's further to Friday night, the Pac-12 title game. I think I said something to the effect on our preview pod of, you know what, I could see Utah winning this game, but I would almost guarantee that it's not another trouncing by Utah. Boy, was I wrong. This was in fact another trouncing by Utah, 38-10, in a game that Utah controlled from the start. Really was never all that close. It was 23-0 at the half. Kind of a nightmare game for the Oregon offense and Anthony Brown. And what we now know is Mario Cristobal's final game with the Oregon Ducks.
Yeah, like you said, you know, we expected this one to be a lot closer this time around. I've said that Oregon, with pretty stupid reasoning, admittedly, thought that Oregon, 2 weeks after getting boat raced by Utah, would come back with something a little bit better to account for Utah's attack and to, you know, maybe get a little bit more going on offense, but nay, on both fronts, Utah really ending the year hot, like scorching hot. And you know, now they get a Rose Bowl berth out of it. I believe it's the first in program history. So cheers to them for that. But yeah, if you're Oregon, it's not just the way that this season ended, but now Cristobal is gone. And I guess we could use that as a jumping off point to talk about that a little bit further. I mean, it makes all the sense in the world. I'm just a little bit surprised, just kind of with the 1,000-foot view of the way this coaching season carousel has unfolded. It's kind of amazing to me that USC and Miami are the winners of all this, because I think getting Mario Cristobal to Miami is such a huge windfall, and they paid so much to do it. I think Miami leads all of college football in this cycle for money paid, you know, having to buy out Cristobal from his contract at Oregon, having to pay out Manny Diaz and to get a new contract for Cristobal. It's a lot of coin. And apparently Miami has famously in the past been more penny pinching with their sort of athletic department decisions. So for them to do this is a big kind of sea change for the Canes. And I'm very interested and excited to see what Cristobal is able to do in an area that he's obviously extremely familiar with. And, you know, in an ACC that, you know, that there's paths to getting a program right back into the national conversation pretty quickly, if you can get that excitement going back around the U in a more sustainable way.
Yeah, it's surprising to see Miami shell out that kind of coin for a head coach. And when you look into it, people on Twitter were sharing this, that apparently the university has come into some money because they've been like printing cash from a hospital on campus that they have some sort of deal with. So actually overpriced medical care is now paying for the head coaching salary.
That is so Miami. I absolutely love it. I actually was just watching, I don't know if you tangenting right here, but there's a great show on Nat Geo called Trafficked. And one of the episodes was about black market plastic surgery. And they spent a lot of the episode down in Miami. Not that that was connected to the university, but, you know, vibes.
I was also doing some recon on Mario Cristobal's Wikipedia page over the weekend. And I noticed a fantastic section under the personal life header that he was extremely close to becoming a U.S. Secret Service agent in 1998. He even went as far as to inform the University of Miami, where he was then a grad assistant. He met with his players and said all of his goodbyes, but then the next day he changed his mind and showed back up to the team. Like kind of the like real life incarnation of the "I'm not leaving" gif.
And like, if you look at Cristobal, the cut of his jib, I could see that. I feel like he would be
kind of Secret Service-y. Yeah, he's got good
very,
size.
Very
protective.
Yeah, no, he would have done great with that, but he's obviously done all right as a coach as well.
Probably and made the right call.
I would say so as well. And then I would like to hear your thoughts too. Like when it came down on Sunday, where it was like, okay, Miami's given Cristobal this ultimatum, and if he doesn't take the job, then we're keeping Manny Diaz. So, yeah. What do you think Manny Diaz's weekend was like? That's tough.
I mean, can you even come back at that point? Like, I almost feel like if you're Manny Diaz, you're like forced into a potential resignation. Like, you just got completely big dogged by your own employer. Like, kind of pantsed in front of your team if they try to bring you back after that.
Yeah, no one's listening to you at that point. So that I do feel like Miami definitely did him dirty in that respect. Just the public airing out of letting him be twisting in the wind to that extent was tough look.
Before we move on, do any like obvious candidates stick out to you for the next Oregon coach? I mean, we've kind of had to cycle through so many names with like these, you know, big job after big job transitioning in the last week and a half. But I, you know, maybe just because we're running out of names, I haven't really seen too much thrown around over these last, you know, 24, 48 hours since Cristobal left. Like the only name that's kind of been thrown out there, and it's usually a little bit tongue in cheek, is Chip Kelly. But you know, I looked at a few articles of you know, people either adjacent to the Oregon program or more national sources throwing out some names, and you see Matt Campbell, you see Dave Aranda, you know, you see Joe Brady, who was recently let go by the Panthers. Dan Mullen's name came up on a few lists. I would like to personally nominate Chris Peterson So, if he ever wants to make a return, this would kind of seem like a kind of an ideal spot to jump back in. But do any of those names or someone else that you might have in mind stick out as a really good fit for you?
Yeah, it's interesting. It doesn't feel like that there's any home run hires left to be hit here. And oddly enough, I would have thought that, with everything that transpired, that maybe Nevada's Jay Norvell would have been interesting to Oregon. He takes a completely lateral move and goes to Colorado State yesterday. So I don't even know what to make of that. But that surprising in conference. And I would kind of argue that Colorado State's a step down from Nevada, but yeah, very strange, but I digress. But I mean, the names that you mentioned, those would all be very, very solid guys. I think Matt Campbell would be my favorite of that group. I think Chip Kelly would be my least favorite of that group. Mullen, I more so see him taking this next year off and then maybe if the NFL is interested in him, although I'm sure his kind of overall coaching stock is down just a bit after the way things ended at Florida. But Oregon, I feel like, is kind of left if I'm a Ducks fan, I'm pretty nervous about the way that this next few weeks are going to go as far as securing that the coaching hire and making sure it's the right guy. If I'm Oregon, if I'm Phil Knight and so on, I do everything in my power probably to get a guy like Matt Campbell, even if Matt Campbell, his season at Iowa State, obviously underwhelmed, and they kind of took themselves out of national prominence with some early losses this season. But I still think Matt Campbell's a great coach and a great program builder. But obviously, expectations are a little bit different at Oregon. It's not just getting you wins the way it is at Iowa State. It's a little bit loftier there, of course, after all these Pac-12 championship appearances, Rose Bowl appearances, and so on. But I believe that if Matt Campbell wanted to take that next step, Oregon would be a good place to do it.
Yeah. And I found some odds for next Oregon head coach, and Matt Campbell comes in at 9-1, kind of right in the middle of the pack. Chip Kelly's the favorite here, pal. He's at +175. You got Justin Wilcox, the current Cal coach, right behind him at 2-1, Joe Brady, 4-1, Brian Harsin, 5-1, Kalani Sitake, 6-1, Chris Peterson's 11-1, Aranda's 14-1. The Aranda thing is interesting because I think to me that would clearly be a step up, but I also feel like Aranda, it seems like he really wants to be in this position where he's continuing to build up Baylor, and maybe a few years from now, if he does stay there, the gap between a program like Baylor and Oregon, we don't look at it as being so cavernous.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, and I think you can only be extremely encouraged, obviously, with what Aranda's been able to do these last couple of seasons at Baylor. I think it's going to take a bit to pry him away. I don't necessarily see him leaving Waco. He's obviously in a great state for recruiting, way more talent rich. Oregon, you got to go into California. That gets a lot trickier now with Lincoln Riley there. So I think if you're Aranda, just stay put. Maybe ask for a nice little raise, something like that. But boy, if Chip Kelly is the favorite, then Oregon is just kind of the verbal meme of the guy putting on the face paint, and then like the next slide over, he's got the clown wig on as well. That would be such a bad move for Oregon. I think I'm not a Chip Kelly guy.
It feels like there would just be almost an impossible standard to live up to, right? It's like, all right, we're just gonna pick up right where we left off back in 2011 or whatever it was when he left there. And there's a small chance that could happen, but there is a much larger chance that I think it would, things have changed over the last decade. And I think he would be kind of chasing some ghosts of years past that Oregon can certainly return to being that program. I just don't think hiring the guy who did it, 12 years earlier or whatever is the way to achieve that.
No, I don't think anything about what Kelly's done at UCLA makes you think at Oregon, like, oh yeah, no, we got to get him back. The guy's just not that interested in recruiting. I think that his system isn't quite, it's something that people have learned and built on and improved upon while he's kind of stayed the same. And I just don't think it would, there's just no way that works out well, the reunion.
So on Sunday, we got news that Brett Venables will be taking over at Oklahoma, somewhat out of nowhere. I mean, obviously Oklahoma needed a coach. Obviously they wanted to make a splash. But you know, by all accounts, Venables was very satisfied being the defensive coordinator at Clemson. Of course, he does have connections to Oklahoma, where he served as the DC, the assistant head coach, for several years in the mid to late 2000s. But what do you make of this hire overall?
It feels like a B plus. Feels like a good hire, but I think that at the end of the day, that we now know for sure that Oregon has taken a step back as far as its head coach goes. Clemson's been blessed to have Venables not be interested in other big time jobs over the course of these last few years with the defenses that he put together at Clemson, the job he did recruiting, you know, churning out all these first round talents on defense out of Clemson. He's done a great job there. If he can, you know, kind of get the defensive side of the equation figured out for Oklahoma in a way that they simply haven't in, I don't know, maybe ever, or, you know, you'd have to go back to the 90s type of thing. Yeah. Then, you know, that this could change some things and, you know, gives them some backbone going into the SEC whenever they make that transition. He's obviously got to get the offense and the offensive coordinator correct. I've heard that Lebby from Ole Miss would be kind of near the top of his list. If he's able to get Lebby in there, then I think that provides a significant boost. But I'm never crazy this day and age in getting a defensive coach. I know that I understand the irony of that being a guy who roots for a team that Kirby Smart head coaches. But it doesn't feel like Venables is like that prodigal son the way that Smart was for Georgia or anything like that. And Venables, I don't know, maybe this hire is a little bit splashier. We talked about this a little bit off air. If Clemson's coming off a year like we have come to expect from them, but I don't know. I'm sure it'll be fine, but I don't know if he's going to be the next coach that wins them a national title. I think that we're going to see another coach after this one. I don't necessarily see this being like a legendary tenure from Brent Venables.
Right. And I think what's most interesting is you're going from being the team that was all offense, no defense, to hiring a defensive coordinator, a guy who knows defense and is going to want to make this a defensive program. And it's not like you can't win that way, but you know, we've seen teams be able to find a lot of success being a really good offense with an okay defense. There's not a lot of teams that have a great defense and an okay offense that find success. You know, it's like the only team that kind of bucks that trend is like Alabama or Clemson when you have great, you know, you have great sides on both ends of the ball. But it's just a big swerve, I guess, for an Oklahoma team that's pretty much been synonymous and kind of been at the forefront of this extreme tilt towards explosive offenses in college football. And you know, it's not to say that they can't still do that, but you know, when you go from perhaps the most explosive, innovative offensive coach to a defensive hire like this, it's just a big sea change, I guess, for a team that is going to have kind of a new identity, we think, going forward.
Yeah, and you know, there's so much to being the head coach that's different than just being a great coordinator. Like, you know, he's been able to just completely focus on his guys, his side of the ball. Dabo Swinney has obviously managed everything else and been like a great CEO of that program at Clemson. So I think there's just a lot of unknowns here. I'm not going to say that it can't work out, but like you said, it's definitely a jarring stylistic change for Oklahoma to get a defensive minded guy like this. A lot of this, again, always comes down to what his support staff looks like, how he rounds out the rest of those coaching hires. If he can hit it right as far as the OC goes, I'd imagine that the defense will be better under him. And, you know, we'll go from there. But I don't view this as like a home run hire by any means.
No, not a bad hire, though. I think if you're Oklahoma, you at least got a name. You know, I think to me, if your goal was kind of to appease the fan base or appease donors, you know, it's like, hey, we got the Clemson defensive coordinator. That to me, you know, right or wrong, that ultimately is maybe a little bit easier to sell to a mm-hmm. fan base than saying like, hey, we hired the Kansas State head coach, you know, that type of thing.
True. Now that's a very good point. He is a name. He you know, I'd say he's one of the most well-known college coordinators, you know, or has become that for several years now. I mean, I don't think that there are very many other coordinators that have that sort of name cachet. So yeah, everyone knows Venables. Everyone knows, you know, his scowl on the sideline and everything like that. He is a intimidating looking individual. So I'm looking for the Sooners to be a little bit tougher at the very least.
Yeah, absolutely looks the part of a guy who played linebacker in the 90s. Like, no question about it. Every single thing about him. By the way, we get kind of an interesting slash sad Alamo Bowl matchup between Oregon and Oklahoma. Kind of one of the low-key intriguing bowls.
That is strange, and it's too bad because we don't really know if we're going to get like a, you know, a max result type of outcome. But yeah. The Alamo Bowl for years has become my favorite non-New Year's Six bowl. That's also not, of course, the Popeye's Bahamas Bowl that always leads us off on that Friday. But yeah, Alamo Bowl has had some wild games in recent years. Or the Oregon TCU game from like 6-7 years ago goes down as literally one of my favorite bowl games of all time. It feels like this one might be lesser than the sum of its parts just because of everything that's happened over the offseason with these two teams.
Yeah, we already know Kayvon Thibodeau will not play in this game. I think that's probably the first of many dominoes that could end up falling before this one ultimately kicks off. But we pretty much made it here, man. We got Army-Navy this coming Saturday. As always, the only game on the slate. And then, you know, we could start looking ahead two Fridays from now. We got the Bahamas Bowl and we got the Tail Greeter Cure Bowl. What is Tail Greeter?
You know, I'm not sure. I do look forward to familiarizing myself with the sponsors of each of these bowl games. But when we sit down next and preview bowl season, because there are some goofy ones this year, to say the least. So I look forward to breaking those down.
I feel like they get more and more obscure every year. Like, there are some years where like the names just like sound funnier. But like I don't even know like half of the companies that are sponsoring these bowls. I'm looking up what Tail Greeter is, and it says it is a digital marketplace that aims to make tailgating more accessible to fans all over the world by having them join local enhanced tailgate hosts. So like an Airbnb for tailgating, kind of.
Okay.
I'm seeing
the theory behind it. I'm amazed that they're staked to, you know, in a position to sponsor a bowl game. That's impressive. Right. But we've seen some companies pop up over the years. I remember Battle Frog got the Fiesta Bowl. Yeah,
it's, of course.
What are they up to now? What's Battle Frog now?
I have no idea. You can kind of picture. I didn't know what it was then. I don't know what it is now. But you can kind of picture the elevator meeting for this, right? Where it's like, all right, we're putting all of our eggs in this basket. And, you know, for this Northern Illinois Coastal Carolina matchup, like, this is going to be it. Like, it reminds me of the AM radio guy on Hot Rod. It's like, I'm putting all my eggs in this basket. You know, it's all about FM and color TV. But this event is going to bring back AM radio. I feel like Tail Greeter's kind of in that same spot.
I can't add to that. That was absolutely perfect. I similarly have that tattoo. And you know, with the other bowl sponsors, and then, you know, Tail Greeter floating safely ahead.